So thank you everyone for joining Torah in Motion for part three of Shuli's series on biblical archaeology and the texts of Nach. So yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you everybody. So the sources are in the chat and they're also obviously on the screen, so you have that too. So hello from wintry Gush Etzion. And we are going to talk today. We're going to move on from the book of Joshua, from Sefer Yoshua. We are going to move on to the book of Judges. And we're going to do the first of two on the book of Judges. Judges, Shoftim, it's the same thing. So when it says Shoftim, that just means judges. It was just easier for me to pick one and to use it. So we are going to do two different units today. We're going to do a little bit of an introduction, and we're going to talk about a majorly important site in the history of the land of Israel, not only in Sefer Shoftim, but throughout history, and that's the Jezreel Valley. And we're going to focus on two battles, two major stories that take place there, the story of Devorah and Barak and the story of Gideon. Next time, we're going to kind of zero in on Shiloh, because Shiloh also very significant in the early years of the Jewish people, of Bnei Israel. And it's also the place of the denouement of the final story of Sefer Shoftim. And that, of course, is the terrible story of the concubine of Pilegesh Bagiv'ah. So we're going to talk about that next time. Hey, this time our stories are a little bit more cheerful. So first of all, just a quick introduction. Yes, somebody asked if Maxine, if you could mute everybody, which I'm seeing you're doing. A quick introduction. Sefer Shoftim is a very different book than Sefer Yoshua, than the book of Joshua. We have, whereas in the book of Joshua, everything seems very triumphant and moving smoothly and going from entering the land and the covenant and conquering one place after another, falling like dominoes. And then we have the nice, neat, giving up, giving out the land, parceling out the land. Sefer Shoftim is much more broken up, let's say. The people are most definitely not united. We're going to hear a lot about tribal groups and tribal conflicts, and each judge rules over certain places, but definitely not over everybody. And also we have a lot of conflicts, whereas in Sefer Yoshua, everything seems to go so smoothly. Here we have many enemies, many battles. What's going on, right? So there are different ways to look at the book, and I'm going to just offer a couple of ideas, but there really are so many. It depends also, are you coming from the traditional commentaries, the more academic commentaries? Are we talking about the one book following the other, meaning the book of Joshua is this triumphant conquest? Ah, very good. Everything's wonderful. We've conquered. But then there's the cleanup. We didn't get rid of everybody. There are a lot of enemies who stay on in the land, and that's very clear from the book of Joshua and certainly from the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. And then we have all these skirmishes that are going on. So is it one after the other? Is this parallel? And there are two different ways of looking at the story. Yoshua is more of the utopian way. Shoftim is maybe the reality. Yechezkel Kaufman, one of very important early Bible scholars, early modern Bible scholars, he talks about two different wars. He talks about the war in the book of Joshua as a war of conquest, kibush. But he says the book of Judges is a war of chirut, we could call it freedom fighters, right? There are still foreigners in the land, and we still have to free ourselves from them. And again, last time I said this also, not to get too political, but we can really compare between the lightning battles and the success of the Six-Day War and the 50-plus years of the skirmishes we've been going on with the population that has been conquered by us in the Six-Day War. So lots of different ways to look at it. The reality in the book of Judges is that there are many, many unconquered areas, and there are many pockets of enemies. There are also enemies who come from the outside. But probably the most significant message that comes through very clearly in Sefer Shoftim, and we're going to see it in a minute, is there is anarchy and there is no unity. Okay, we keep hearing over and over, everybody does as they wish. Ish hayashar be'enav yaseh. It's a perfect prelude to our next book, which is Sefer Shmuel, where the people come and they say, we want a king. We don't like this anymore. This is not working for us. All right. And so we're going to see that as we go along. And finally, and I'm really just going to mention this, there's so much to say about it, but we are not going to get into it too deeply. When does the story take place? Okay? Even if you are not going according to more academic, not necessarily dati, religious scholars who will say the book was written long, long, long after the events happened, whereas the Gemara talks about the prophet Samuel writing the book. Even if you're taking a more traditional approach, it is not at all clear that the stories in the book are in chronological order. Here we're going to see that Devorah is considered one of the earliest stories. The stories at the end of the tribe of Dan looking for a new home, of the story of Pelegish Bagivah, did they take place at the end of the period, or are they put at the end of the book because in a literary sense, it's a great way to end the book. It's a terrible way to end the book, but it's this climax of things just getting worse and worse and more anarchic and more anarchic. Does it mean it happened at the end? Not necessarily. Okay. So those are a lot of things to keep in mind, as we go along. So let's just get a basic outline of the book. And again, so many different things to talk about. We're not even going to touch the Philistines, which is a huge story in and of itself. We'll talk about them more perhaps in Sefer Shmuel, but let's just get a basic outline. Okay. The first two chapters are a bit of an introduction. Excuse me. We hear about the land that has not been conquered yet. We're going to see a map of it in a minute. It's called in the text Haaretz Hanisheret, the land that's left over, right? The land that has not yet been conquered. We're going to hear about various skirmishes that different tribes have in their areas. That's chapter one. Chapter two, we're going to get the larger picture, the moral picture of the book. More on that in the next slide. Okay. And then we sort of dive into this interesting list of different judges. So some judges get a whole chapter or a few chapters. Their stories are very big. Some judges just get a verse or two here and there. So chapter three, we have three different judges, only one of whom gets a real story. We have Otniel ben Knaz versus my favorite king in the book of Judges, because how can you not like this name? Kushan Rishathaim from Aram Naharaim. Ehud ben Gera versus Eglon. He's the only one that we get a full story. He's a lefty. He plunges his sword into Eglon, who's a fat king, right? These are stories that everybody remembers from elementary school because they're great stories. And then we have Shamgar ben Anat versus the Philistines, but not a lot of detail. Our most detailed story yet is going to be with Devorah and Barak against Sisera and the Canaanites. We're going to go deeply into that. We're also going to talk about the next lengthy story, and that's the story of Gideon against the Midianites, right? We have a chapter about Abimelech, who is not a judge in the sense that we have of the other judges, that he comes along and he saves the people from an enemy and he teaches them how to behave. Abimelech is one of the worst, right? He's a terrible guy. He kills off his brothers. He only has one who's left who admonishes him, but from far away. And he tells this great parable, right? Mashal Yotam. Another great story that we're not going to go into, but he's an outlier in all these stories. And then we've got, again, a few minor judges, Tola ben Pua, Yair HaGiladi. Hey, we have the story of Yiftach, who gets a little bit more space. Hey, Yiftach against the people of Ammon. Then we have a few more minor judges. And then we have our last judge who gets a real significant section. And that, of course, is Samson, Shimshon, and the Philistines. And finally, the last few chapters of the book are these two stories. One seemingly innocent, but it has a lot of an undercurrent of violence and anarchy in it. And that's the tribe of Dan, who doesn't like their area that they got, and they move up north and they conquer a new area. And then the terrible, terrible story, like I said, we'll talk about it last time, of the Pelegish Bagivah. One story that we do not have in the book of Judges, even though it says explicitly in the beginning of the story that it happens, B'yimei Shvot HaShoftim, in the time of the judges, is of course Rut, right? Migilat Rut, because here we hear, if you look at the very beginning of Migilat Rut, right, we find out that it happens B'yimei Shvot HaShoftim. Right, just read it. Right, why is Rut not included? Because Rut is a very different story. Hey, Rut is a story where people take care of each other, where there's a lot of kindness, where there's chesed, the whole trajectory of the story, including Ruth's behavior, Boaz's behavior. Everybody's looking out for each other and helping each other. It doesn't fit with the book of Shoftim, right? It's a very different kind of book. And so it gets its own place and it doesn't seem to fit in here. Someone said some of the judges have women's names. That's interesting. I never thought about that. Pua is not necessarily a women's name. We have, by the way, Tola ben Pua is an interesting one because those are both, he's from Yisachar. Those are both names of dyes, right? And maybe the Yisacharites were dyers. Who else has a woman's name? Oh, Anat. Interesting. I don't know. I don't know if anybody speaks about that. It's a good point. Okay. So this is the classic. I must admit, I stole this image off of a Christian site. The Christians are big on the book of Judges. But it's very obvious that this is what's going on. It doesn't have to be obvious. You don't have to figure it out from reading the book. It actually says it very clearly in the second chapter of the book that this is what's going to happen. People serve the Lord, then they fall into sin and idolatry. They are enslaved by various outsiders. They cry out. God gives them a judge. They're delivered. Everything's nice. And then we go back again, right? And that's the classic story of what's going on. Nobody learns a lesson. And there is no moral center in the book. Okay? And that's what I put here in the top here. And we have variations on this phrase in different places. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did as he pleased. Ish hayashar be'einav yaseh. It's a phrase that we love to use in Israeli politics today. And unfortunately, sometimes it's true. But it's very clear from so many different things in the book that there is no true leadership. Certainly at the end, the Pilegesh Bagiv'ah story and the civil war that happens, it happens because one guy is outraged by a terrible thing that happened that's really his fault. Right. And he calls to everybody to have a civil war. A tribe is almost completely eradicated. There is no guiding hand. Right. Another smaller example, but a powerful example. We have the story of Yiftach, who makes a vow. And he says, if I win in this battle, the first creature to come out of my house to greet me, I'm going to give as a sacrifice. And his daughter comes out and nobody comes along and says, but wait, that vow, it's not a real vow. It doesn't count. You don't have to do it. Right. There's nobody who seems to be taking leadership. And that's a very significant thing. We have, of course, the external troubles, right? The nations that are on the outside that are attacking, but those same nations are causing the internal troubles. We know already from the book of Joshua, from the beginning of the book of Judges, that there are many who are left untouched. Even in all these conquests, there are cities that are not conquered. We're going to see that in a second. And those are pockets of idolatry and pockets of bad influence on the children of Israel. And that's part of the story of the cycle here. Okay, so this is a good map for a couple of reasons. Again, the places where the judges come from, sometimes it's really clear. We're going to see Devorah. We know exactly where she is. Shimshon, we know exactly where he is. Others, Elon, right? We're not so sure. Shamgar, right? Maybe he's from a place called Beit Anat. There's your answer. Is his name his mother's name, or that's just his place? Some of these are very conjectural. But what's interesting about this map, even if we don't take each one as gospel truth, and I think this also was from a Christian site, so, you know, gospel truth, there you go, is that it's very tribal, right? It's very tribal. Each judge is from a particular tribe, not ruling over everybody. And it's very clear in many of the stories, we're going to encounter this in the Devorah story, in the Gidon story, and in others as well, that some tribes come to the battles, other tribes don't. Some tribes are resentful at not being called. Some tribes are there. There's a lot of anger at them that they don't show up, right? We also have a lot of between two tribes conflicts, right? So just to give you a couple of examples, right? Samson, he is fighting the Philistines, but the elders of Judah, right? Samson's from Dan over here, and he's right next door to Judah. The people of Judah don't like him so much, and they're not so happy about the trouble that he's stirring up, right? An even more extreme example before we even get to the story of the Civil War, but an even more extreme example is Yiftach, right? Here's Yiftach from Menasheh, from Gilad. he goes to battle against Ammon. The people of Ephraim, they come to him. What's the matter? Why didn't you call us? Right? And instead of kind of deflecting their anger as Gideon does in his time, he basically starts a war with them. So we have a lot of this internal conflict that's going on here. The other thing that's nice to see in this map, I hope you guys can see the contrast nicely. The dark green areas are the areas that are controlled by the Israelites. The light, the yellower areas, are what we call the Aretz HaNisharet, the land that has yet to be conquered. And many of these places are not conquered even to the very end of First Temple times. The Philistines don't leave. They are subdued somewhat in the time of King David, but they don't leave. Other places like the Jezreel Valley that we're going to be spending time talking about are more subjugated under the Israelites, but the nations that are there, they have to pay taxes, they have to work, but they don't leave. Okay, so where can we see this Aretz HaNisharet, this remaining land? The coast, right? The coast is always, in biblical times and Second Temple times and later, the coast is always a place of the non-Israelites, okay? And the valley, okay? And we're going to be talking about the valley, the Jezreel Valley, very important. Why these particular areas, whereas B'nai Israel are able to take what this is, which is the hills? Because the Canaanites, as we're going to see, have a fabulous weapon. It is called Rechev Barzel, right? An iron chariot. At this point, the children of Israel have not yet figured out the technology of iron chariots. They don't yet have horses. We're going to see King Solomon and later on Achav. They have chariots and they have horses, and that's a really big deal. But at this early stage, we don't have that. Now, chariots are very, very useful and very nice on the flat places, in the valleys. They're not quite as useful in the mountains. And we're going to see that in the story of Barak and Sisera, also with Gideon a little bit, right? So the Israelites are able to take the mountains because the chariots can't venture up there, but they can't take the valley, right? The valley stays in the control of these other nations, okay? So that's just to get us started, but we are going to focus now on one particular part of this map, and that, of course, is Emek Israel, this very large, triangular-shaped, and super important valley. Okay, so everybody keep that in your mind. Somebody just asked me for a map. Almost everything that I have is stolen from the internet. Not stolen. I try to take things that are free, but you can find it yourself. Okay, Yofi. So let's understand the topography of the land of Israel for a moment, because it's going to be very important for our story. So two interesting maps. One is from the Ophrah Field School. One is just kind of a satellite-ish map. Okay, let's look at this one on the right first, because it's really very – no, let's look at the one on the left first, because we get the whole look of the land. Okay, basically what you can see here is that you have a spine of mountains that go down the center of the country from the Galilee through Samaria down to Yehudah, into the Negev, and in fact, all the way down to Eilat, okay? There is a drop-off, a moderate sort of a drop-off towards the sea in the west. There's a more dramatic drop-off towards the Jordan Valley and the Dead Sea in the east, but basically you have the spine of mountains. So if I wanted to travel and go somewhere, right, I want to go from north to south, I can go up the sea, right, the Via Maris, Derech Hayam. I can go up the King's Highway on the other side of the Jordan over here. That's all very nice. But what if I want to get from here, from Egypt to here, right, to the Hittites, to the Babylonians, to wherever? How do I get from one side to the other? Okay, so what I have to do is I have to have a crossing point. And the best crossing point is this Jezreel Valley, nice and flat and wide and empty. I got tons of space. It's beautiful, right? Now, there are other valleys that become important in other battles, the Elah Valley, the Ayalon Valley, but they don't go all the way through. They are significant, but they are not as significant. The Jezreel Valley is the most important one, and you can see it nicely on this map too. This is just the valley, right? This is kind of zeroing in on it, and you can see how big it is and how it takes you all the way across to Beit Shean, Right. And then you can continue either on this side going up towards Chatzor. We're going to talk about Chatzor and why it's so important is partly because it's on this route. Or you can cross the Jordan and go up on the other side. Either way, Jezreel Valley, now that we've made a big mess, super, super significant. And whoever controls it controls trade, controls armies, right? Controls everything. The Canaanites can hold on to it, Canaanites and any other enemy who might be around, because they have these chariots, and the chariots work very nicely here in the Jezreel Valley. So everybody wants this. However, not everybody is able to have it. And it's only much later in Israelite history that we get control of it. Okay. This is not a place we're going to talk about now. We're going to talk about it in, with Eliyahu, but this is a very important site, Megiddo, right? This is the Tell of Megiddo. It's a really interesting site with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of history, but it is also at the western edge of the valley. You can see how it beautifully controls the valley, right? Now, Megiddo, if you say it quickly, or if you say it with its mountain name, Har Megiddo, sounds a lot like a place that is very significant to Christians, which is Armageddon, right? And if you go to Megiddo, in the old days when we still had tourists, and Bezrat Hashem again, you will see busload upon busload of Christian tourists who are coming to see the site, because they say that this is the place of Armageddon. Armageddon, i.e. the final important battles, Gog and Magog, right? The battles that are going to change history. Why do they say this, right? Armageddon is just a strange pronunciation of Har Megiddo. Why is this the place of these battles? Because this is a place of battles. We have battles here from the beginning of recorded history in our area. Okay. Paro Tutmos, 15th century before the Common Era, he comes to fight in Canaan. He fights near Megiddo, going all the way up and including World War I, General Alamy fights in Megiddo. And in fact, when he is, I don't even know what the word are, if we have any British people, they can help me. But when he is knighted, he becomes a Viscount, right? You get to choose a name, and he chooses that he wants to be the Viscount of Megiddo, because Megiddo is so significant for him. So just the fact that this is the place of battles tells you that everybody wants to control this entryway to the valley. But like I said, we're going to go to Megiddo a different time. We are going to head into our story of Devorah, Barak, and Sisra. Okay? Who are our players? So I highlighted them for you here, and we're going to be talking about them in different places, right? We're going to talk about Yavin, who reigned in Chatzor. We're going to come to him in a minute. We're going to hear about his commander, whose name is Sisra, in a place called Haroshet Goyim. Okay? He has, as we said, iron chariots. Okay, Devorah, who sits under the palm of Devorah, okay, in the hill country of Ephraim, and Barak, who is in Naphtali. The only person who we don't hear about here who's important is Yael of the Cani. We're not going to talk about her so much, but it's nice to know that she exists. Okay, where is everybody? Devorah is in Har Ephraim, in the mountains of Ephraim, in the area of Ramah and Beit El. We get a really nice identification for her. Okay, the fact that she is a judge and she is female is very unusual. I am not going to go into it. I don't have anything brilliant to say about it, but there are commentaries to talk about it, and it is definitely something that is not run of the mill, but it does give us a sense that being a judge is not only about being a warrior. And in fact, she is not a warrior. She has to recruit a warrior to do the fighting for her, as opposed to the other judges. And her fighter is Barak, who comes from Kedesh in Naphtali, which there are a few different identifications for where that is. Okay. He's going to go to Mount Tabor. We're going to talk about that too. And meanwhile, the battles are going to be taking place here in the valley. Okay, so that's just to give us some of our background, but let's understand who is Yavin and who is Sisra. Okay, so who is the enemy? We have two people here. We have Yavin, the king of Canaan, who rules in Chatzor, and we have Sisra in Haroshet Goyim. So we're going to talk about both of them, but first Yavin. Now, we know Chatzor. Chatzor is a super important place. It is an enormous tell. It is one of the largest ancient cities in Israel. Today, you can go and see it. It's an amazing tell. up in the north, not far from Rosh Pina, from Tzfat. It has a huge remains of a huge Canaanite city, which, as you can see in this really nice aerial photograph here, has an upper city and a lower city. It was already excavated by Yigael Yadin in the 50s and 60s, excavated again, Amnon Ben-Tor and other excavations in the middle. Okay? After the Canaanite period, it becomes a much smaller city. Okay? And I'll just show you one other cool thing that you could see here. It becomes a much smaller city, an Israelite city, and we hear about it as one of King Solomon's cities. We're going to talk a little about that when we get to the Book of Kings. And you can see here beautifully the six-chambered gates that is always ascribed to King Solomon. But we are talking about Hazor in its Canaanite days. It is a large and powerful city. We hear about it in the Book of Joshua as the Yavin, the king of Canaan in Hazor, same name, we'll get back to that. Okay, he's the one who assembles a coalition of the northern kings to fight against Joshua. This is the final battles that we hear about in the Book of Joshua after he conquers Jericho and the Ai and the Givonim and the south. He moves up north and he conquers Hazor. It is such a powerful city. Why? It's in a great location. It's on a major road. So it has lots of trade. We know that we have artifacts here from Egypt. We hear about Hazor in the Mari texts. We hear about a guy named King Ibn Abdu, who maybe is Yavin. Okay. There's a large ritual site here, temples upon temples upon temples. Super, super important place. But what's the story going on here? We hear very clearly in the Book of Joshua that Hazor is destroyed. Okay. So if Hazor is destroyed in the Book of Joshua, how is it appearing? Where is Yavin coming from in the Book of Judges? So let's just take a look and see. We have both textual as well as archaeological proof that Hazor is destroyed. In the Book of Joshua, chapter 11, Joshua turned back and captured Hazor and put her king to the sword. Hazor was formerly the head of all those kingdoms. Okay, it's the most important. Not a soul survived. Hazor was burnt down. Joshua captured all the royal cities and their kings. However, all those towns that are still standing were not burned by Israel. It was Hazor alone that Joshua burned down. Why should we destroy all of them? They're useful. We'll move in. Only Hazor was destroyed. And if you say, oh, that's very utopian, it didn't really happen, Amnon Ben-Tor, who excavated in Hazor relatively recently, found what Yigael Yadin did not find. He concentrated more on the lower city and on the water system and King Solomon's gates. But Amnon Ben-Tor found an enormous building, right? This is the building that you see over here that today has a modern roof on it, built by the preservationists. But this is an enormous building with a huge entrance, with enormous pillars, with a bama in the front of it, with an altar in the front of it. But the most fascinating thing about this building, it is clearly destroyed by a massive conflagration. You can see evidence in the burnt areas where there was wood in the wall. There's no more wood. The mud bricks are charred. You can tell that there was a huge fire here. And we hear about a fire, right? Hazor is burnt by fire. We also have an enormous Baal figure, an enormous figure of the idol Baal that has been decapitated. And Amnon Ben-Tor dates this all to the time of Joshua. And he says Hazor is one of those places that it's clear that the book is telling you, the sources are telling you what happened. So what's going on, right? How do we have a Hazor here and a king of Yavin over here in Joshua and then again in the book of Judges? So we have a few different approaches. I'm going to throw out a few ideas for you. The traditional approach, the Radak says this as well as other people, is that Yavin is not a personal name. It's a dynastic name, right? Like Paro, right? There are a lot of Yavins. And the Yavin in Joshua is the grandfather. The Yavin in Judges is the grandson. And after Hazor is destroyed, Yavin's family somehow escapes, reestablishes themselves in the Canaanite enclave of the Jezreel Valley. And grandson Yavin is the one who is carrying on the fight, the last battles against the Israelites. That's one approach. That's a very traditional approach. A more academic approach says that this is the same story. The book of Judges has one version. The book of Joshua has another. And a lot of people say the story of Devorah is one of the oldest stories in the book of Judges, but primarily because of Shirat Devorah, because of the song. Song is a way to keep memories, to keep stories alive, even in a pre-literate society. And the suggestion is that this is in the book of Joshua. It says that the place was destroyed, but the real story, the details of the story, are what we have in Sefer Shoftim with Devorah and Barak, right? Or another suggestion is there are two stages to the story. Devorah conquers, Joshua burns it down. Again, lots of different suggestions, none of which are really perfect. But we have another protagonist here in the whole story, and that's a fellow named Sisera. And he is from a place called Haroshet Goyim. Where is Haroshet Goyim? We don't hear about it anywhere else. We hear about a place called Glil Goyim, but we don't hear about Haroshet Goyim. Where on earth is Haroshet Goyim? So we have lots of suggestions, none of them particularly convincing. but I'm going to share with you in a minute the most unusual suggestion. You can decide if you think it's compelling. The traditional place that people says Haroshet Goyim is here, Kiryat Tivon, not Kiryat Tivon, but a little north of it, in a place near Shar HaAmakim. That's putting it nicely at the northern opening of the valley, right? And Sisera can go here through the valley and in the direction of Mount Tabor, right? Maybe that's a possibility, right? Maybe it's closer to Megiddo over here, or maybe, and this is another suggestion, maybe it's not a city, maybe it's a region, maybe it's a whole area, Haroshet Goyim, right? Like Glil Goyim. We don't have any great answers to where it is. We have not found any Arab village that retains that name. We haven't found any signs that say, welcome to Haroshet Goyim. But here we're going to come across the very interesting archaeologist who we've already mentioned twice before, and that is Adam Zartal. Okay, if you remember Adam Zartal, we talked about him last time and the time before. Adam Zartal, wounded in the Yom Kippur War, becomes an archaeologist despite his disability in his legs and conducts a massive survey of Samaria. He's the guy who finds the altar on Mount Ebal. He's the guy who talks about the Gilgals. And he finds this very odd site. Well, he doesn't find it. In 1992, aerial photographs of the area. Let's go back for a second and see where this is, because I didn't show you. Sorry. Aerial photographs of this area, Katsir. Okay, Katsir is a small little town, kibbutz, I believe. It is right next to Route 6, right, major road going through Israel, and right off of Route 65, another really important road, the Wadi Ara road, cutting through the valley, and is right near a very new and hugely growing city called Harish. Okay. But we want to talk about Katsir. And in 1992, aerial photographs of Katsir revealed a strange sight. Lots of thick walls. Okay. Very thick walls. Now, this is a site that had a name. It was known. Okay. It's called El Ahwat. El Ahwat in Arabic means the walls, because the walls were strange, right? The walls are, number one, very thick, about 5-6 meters thick. Okay. And they are kind of wavy, right? There's really no better word to describe it. They're kind of curvy, which is odd. Why would you build a wall like that? Zartal is, intrigued enough that he decides to dig there, and he finds a very well planned, very fortified, not very settled city. What does that mean? He finds the walls, right? He finds some spaces that are built up inside, but he finds a lot of empty spaces, right? Like over here. Maybe it's, you know, not completed, or maybe you need that space for something else. Now he finds other strange elements in it. They have towers, okay, the walls. They have these weird little dead end corridors. Can you see that over here in the photograph? Okay. They have these strange little rooms that don't seem to lead anywhere. What are they? All right. Now, Zertal, like all archaeologists, looks at a site and has to say, well, what else does it look like? What can we compare it to? And then maybe we can learn something about it. Oh, one more thing that's very important. We can actually date it because we found here Egyptian scarabs. I remember the scarabs that have the pictures, the symbols of various paros. And these are paros from around the time of the Exodus, Seti I, Ramses II, Merneptah, 13th, 12th century before the Common Era. So we know this is around the time that the children of Israel enter the land of Israel. Is it Israelite? Is it Canaanite? It doesn't seem to fit any of those definitions. Different kind of architecture. It has pig bones, which is usually a sign that it's not Israelite, sometimes Canaanite, but not necessarily. It just is strange. It doesn't look like anything else. And when it doesn't look like anything else, you have to look outside. And Zertal hosted all sorts of archaeologists and scholars to come and see it and give their opinions. And somebody who came to see it said, you know, this reminds me of the buildings of a culture called the Nuraghi, N-U-R-A-G-H-E, in Sardinia. Okay, Sardinia, I also had to look it up on the map. Okay, Sardinia is off of the western coast of Italy. Okay, it's part of Italy, and it has some very ancient culture that has strange wavy walls, towers, corridors. What's going on here, right? Why would you have something that's Sardinian over here? And Zertal proposed something fascinating, right? He says, we have a name for all the different groups that come and invade first Egypt and then the coast of the land of Israel. We call them the Goye Hayam, the sea peoples. That's a modern name. Okay. We hear about all different kinds of groups, because the Egyptian king Ramses, okay, who fights against them, and he builds a huge monument to himself, a funerary temple called Medinat Habu. And he has pictures of these different peoples invading Egypt and him rebuffing them. And he lists their names, and you have Peleshet, and you have Shekel, and you have Sardan, and Sokal, and you have Shardan. Who are the Shardan? These are all different peoples. They're not the same. All of them, it seems, come from the West. We always assume they're coming from somewhere in the area of Greece, right? They're all coming from this area, but maybe some of them are coming from further west. And Zertal takes the name Sardinia and says it sounds a lot like Shardona. There's a city in Sardinia called Sisari that sounds a lot like Sisra. And he says maybe this is the origin of the Shardona people. Maybe they're not coming from Greece, from the Aegean Sea, but they're coming further west from Sardinia. If you look at the drawings on the palace, the funerary palace of Medinat Habu, there are drawings of different kinds of warriors who are attacking the Egyptians. Some of them have these fancy feathered helmets, okay? And these are the guys that we identify as the Philistines, because we have other imagery. We have bird images that look a lot like this. But some of them have helmets with horns. And these, it seems, are the Shardona. Okay. Now the Shardona, everywhere we hear about them, they're mentioned in ancient texts. They seem to be mercenaries. They fight for various different nations. And perhaps what Zertal suggests is perhaps Sisra and his Shardona are the mercenaries of the Canaanites. They join together to take the Jezreel Valley. And Sisra, in order to accomplish this, builds his own little town. And he calls it Haroshet Goyim, or somebody calls it Haroshet Goyim, right? Do we have any proof? No, but we do seem to have, it seems to be a logical place. It's a good place to launch an invasion. There is space for his chariots, and an intriguing find that was discovered in El Ahwat is this very beautiful, decorated, very small, right? You can see how big it is. It's about 2 centimeters, right? It's a very small little figurine, but it's not just for beauty. It is attached as a linchpin to a chariot wheel. Okay, think of a hubcap. This is an ancient hubcap. A chariot wheel, very nice, right? Sisera has 900 iron chariots. So maybe this is what's going on. This is Artal's suggestion that Sisera builds himself this capital here, and launches his attack on Barak from here. Now, also intriguing about El Ahwat is it's then abandoned. And we have nothing there until the Romans come along and build a farmhouse on top of it. It's not destroyed. It's abandoned. Is it abandoned because of Sisera's defeat? Is it abandoned because it's not a great site? Who knows, right? But it is a very intriguing and interesting suggestion. And the kibbutz in Katzir has actually been very proactive about preserving the site, and you can actually come and see it, which is nice because you would think, oh, it's just in the fields, they're going to ignore it. But they're excited about it. So what is Barak's plan? What happens? So the traditional approach is that Barak is going, this is Mount Tabor over here, and this is the valley spread below it. The idea is that Barak has his men on Mount Tabor, and he also has them below in the Ksulot Valley. And the idea is that Sisera is going to advance towards Mount Tabor. He's going to try to draw the Israelites down because, of course, he can't fight on the mountain. Naphtali and Zvulun are going to attack Sisera. They will probably be sacrificed. Sisera will then have to flee, and then he'll be ambushed by another, we'll see a picture of all this, by another force coming from the south. Now, that would work very nicely, except it would sacrifice the tribes who are on Mount Tabor, Naphtali and Zvulun. Okay? But instead, Naphtali and Zvulun are saved by a giant rainstorm. This is all the traditional approach. Let's just take a look at it in the picture. Okay. Who's showing up from where? So the dark blue arrows are the Israelites congregating at Mount Tabor. Okay. The light blue is, and this, in this map puts Haroshet Goyim all the way up near Haifa. The light blue is Sisera advancing on Mount Tabor and then attempting to attack. There's a huge surprise summer rainstorm. The iron chariots are useless in a rainstorm. They get bogged down, and Sisera and his men have to retreat. They actually retreat in two different directions, right? The men retreat over here going to the west, but Sisera goes to the east to the tent of Yael, which is a bad calculation on his part. Okay. This is the approach, the traditional approach. And it says based on the song, Shirat Dvorah, right? We piece this together from the narrative in chapter 4 and the poem in chapter 5. And the narrative doesn't tell us why they are fleeing, right? The Lord threw Sisera and all his chariots and armies into a panic before the onslaught of Barad. Sisera leaps from his chariot and fled on foot. We don't know why, right? What's going on? But in the poem, we hear the kings came, they fought. They fought at Tanakh by Megiddo's waters. The stars fought from heaven. Mina kochavim nilchamu, mina shamayim nilchamu hakochavim im Sisera. From their courses, they fought against Sisera. The torrent Kishon swept them away, the raging torrent, the torrent Kishon. What's happening here is what happens occasionally in the Jezreel Valley, whether it's the Kishon River or something else called the Kishion tributary. We're not going to go into it now, but basically Sisera comes out with his iron chariots. It's springtime. Everything should be fine, nice and dry. But then every once in a while, we do have surprise rainstorms in the spring, even in the late spring. And when you have a huge rainstorm, this is actually from the Negev. This is not from the Jezreel Valley, but it's just to give you an idea. When you have a huge torrent of rain into the valley turns into a swamp, and the chariots are useless, and they don't even get to Mount Tabor to be attacked before they are routed and they have to run away. Okay, that is the traditional approach. Zartal sees it in a different way. He says it's not about water, it's about topography, right? He says that Sisera leaves from his place in Katzir, in El Ahwat, okay, and starts to advance towards what he knows is a good passageway. He wants to, like we said, draw Barak down from the mountains. But Barak knows the land better than Sisera, and he leads him into a very narrow area, which is near a spring, right? Ta'anach al Mei Megiddo, by the waters of Megiddo, and Sisera and his chariots get stuck. They're not stuck because of water. They're stuck because it's a very narrow passageway, and that's why he has to run away. So that's Zartal. He's saying the chariots are coming from here. They don't even have to make it all the way over to near Mount Tabor. before, and the water is not connected. Take it or leave it. It's an interesting idea, and it fits nicely with the topography and with the identification of El Ejuat as Jarosha Koyim. One last little bit of Sisra, because I couldn't resist. Mrs. Sisra at the window. Okay? In the song, in Shirat Dvorah, some of us had to learn it by heart in elementary school. Some of us may still be able to recite it. But even if you don't remember most of it, the end has a very poignant almost, right? We don't want to cheer for her. She's the enemy, but it's very evocative. The Sisra's mother is waiting for him to come home, and she doesn't understand why is it taking him so long to come, right? And again, she also mentions the chariot, Mandua Boshesh Richvo Lavo. But what I wanted to point out is the window, right? She's looking through the window, waiting for him to come home. The woman at the window is a classic symbol throughout, from ancient art all the way up to Picasso and even later. This is a great Assyrian sculpture of the woman at the window. Here she is looking out. In Ramat Rachel in Jerusalem, we've discovered window balustrade that looks identical to the one that we have in this ancient sculpture, in this ancient relief, which is amazing. There are women at the window in Tanakh a few times. They rarely have a good end. Besides Mrs. Sisra, there is Michal, okay, the daughter of Shaul, who looks out and makes fun of King David dancing. And we have Jezebel, who puts on her makeup and looks out the window and awaits her death by Yehu. So ladies, stay away from the window. Okay, we are going to do Gideon. We're going to have to do him a little faster. Maybe we'll do some of it next time. We'll see. Okay, so our next story is Gideon. Gideon is in the area of Menasha. The enemy here are the Midianites. Okay, unlike the Canaanites, who are indigenous to the land and they are all here, the Midianites are coming from outside. They are nomadic. They are not particularly interested in conquest and in territory. They are interested in plunder, right? Take a look at what it says. The Israelites did what was offensive to the Lord, right? Our classic prelude. The Lord delivered them into the hands of the Midianites for 7 years. Because of Midian, the Israelites provided themselves with refuges in the caves and strongholds of the mountains. Why? Because after the Israelites had done their sowing, Midian, Amalek, the Kidmites, Kidem, meaning in the east, would come up and raid them. They would attack them, destroy the produce of the land, leave no means of sustenance, not a sheep or an ox or an ass, right? We get this, and we even have this very not PC description of them as locusts, right? They would invade the land and ravage it. And that's why the first time we meet the hero of our story, Gideon, okay, where is he? He is beating wheat inside a wine press. Chovet chitim bagat. Why would you bring your wheat to the wine press? That's not where you do that. Because he's trying to escape. He's going to the unpredictable place so that nobody will know and they won't come and get him. Okay, so here are Midianites. Gideon comes from the tribe of Menasha. Okay? The battles, again, are going to take place in the Jezreel Valley. Where is Gideon from? Right, Gideon is the son of Yoash, Avi HaEzri. He's from the tribe of Menasha, and he's from a place called Ophrah. Okay, now some of you may be familiar with Ophrah. There's a community called Ophrah between Beit El and Shiloh, north of Jerusalem. That's a modern name. It is not the Ophrah of our story. The problem is often we know names because the Arabs retain the names, right? Bitin is Beit El. Safuria is Tzipori. Ophrah is not retained. Why? Because it sounds a lot like an Arabic word, Ifriti, which means a demon. And you don't want to call your town Demonsville, right? So sometimes they would take the town Ophrah and they would change the name to Taibe. Tov, right? So you could look for Taibes, and we have a Taibe up near Tulkarem, right? Up near the area of Kfar Saba. It's like barely on the edge of Menasha. We have another one in the area of Yisachar, which fits nicely with our battle area, but also not really Menasha. Hanan Eshel, Alav HaShalom, talked about how we know that the tribe of Menasha was divided up, like all tribes, into families. We have ostraka, right? Pieces of pottery with writing on them from later, from the time period of Ahav and afterwards that seem to be some kind of tax receipts from the Shomron, and we have a lot of names on them. And one of the names that appears is Avi Ezer, right? Gidon is Avi HaEzri, that's his family. And Hanan Eshel suggests that in this area of Avi Ezer that we're able to identify, not too far from where we were last week, near Mount Gerizim and Shechem, is an area that may be Ofra. We don't know. But it's a nice suggestion because it really puts Gidon squarely in the heart of Shevet Menashe. But in any case, the battle is not going to be taking place near Menashe, but rather again in the north. Now, again, think about these Midianites who have come from all the way down here and they've managed to come all the way up to the Jezreel Valley. They are very powerful. They are very widespread. And Gidon goes up to battle against them. Okay. He gathers his troops by En Harod. Meanwhile, the Midianites come and they encamp to the north of Givat HaMoreh, right? So Gidon is here by En Harod, a little bit north of Gilboa. The Midianites are a little bit south of Mount Tabor near Givat HaMoreh. Here's Mount Tabor over here. It's a really interesting mountain. And the plan is to have two attacks. We hear about this only kind of, it's hinted at, an attack by Mount Tabor, where we find out later that there was a defeat there, and then a second attack by the Midianite camp itself in this valley, in the Ksulot Valley. Okay, so that's what's happening. You can see the pictures very nicely. The purple are the Israelites arriving at the camp in Ma'an Harod. Okay? The Midianite camp is here with the red, and then they retreat and run to the other side, to the Transjordan. I'm putting a little about Tabor, but I think we'll come back to Tabor because we don't have so much time. Let's talk about Ma'an Harod. Right? So they camp at the spring. It's a little south of the mountain called Givat HaMoreh, which you can see here, which has the town of Afula right next to it, right? You can see in the Psukim what it says. But God says to Gidon, you know what? You have too many soldiers, which doesn't seem like it should be a big problem. But God says it's not going to be enough of a miracle. It's not going to show God's hand if we have too many people. So I want you to send some people home. Okay, so first Gidon makes a speech. He says, if you're nervous, if you're frightened, go home, and a large number go home. But he's still left with, according to the text, 10,000 soldiers. So God says, okay, I'm going to give you a way to separate out those who I want and those who I don't want, right? So what happens? He took the troops down to the water, to Ma'an Harod. This is not somebody acting out the story, but it's actually just an old picture that someone saw, this woman coming and drinking, or maybe it is someone acting out the story, but it's a really cool picture. God said to Gidon, set apart all those who lap the water with their tongues like dogs from all those who get down on their knees to drink, right? So Gidon takes all his guys down to the water. He says, everybody take a drink. And he watches how they do it. Some people, most of them, kneel down and then cup the water in their hands and bring it to their mouth. But some, the minority, lie down on the ground and kind of lap the water into their hands. Only 300 of those. And God says, take the lappers and leave the kneelers. Why? So you have all kinds of nice explanations. The kneelers are used to kneeling because they're idol worshipers. The lappers only need a little bit of water, so they're more hardy soldiers. The simplest explanation is that God sees how many of each and says, take the smaller group, right? But in any case, it's a nice thing to kind of bring alive what's going on. You can really see the spring today and understand the story. And then we have Gidon's battle strategy. Okay, and what he does is he takes his 300 men, he divides them into three companies. They encircle the Midianite camp in the middle of the night, right? Ba'ashmoret ha'tichonah, the second watch of the night, the time of the night, whatever it is, 2 a.m, where you're most groggy, you're most sleepy, even the guards are not quite as aware. He gives everybody a pottery jar with a torch inside, a lit torch, and a shofar. And he says, "Mimeni tiru v'chein ta'asu, watch me and do exactly as I do," which, as you can see here, is the motto of the officer's course of the Israeli army. Okay, and he leads them down there, and basically what he does is he says, says, everybody smash your jugs, take out your torches, blow your shofarot. And this, of course, throws the Midianite camp into an absolute panic. They think they are surrounded by thousands of people. They go crazy. They start running around and basically killing each other. You have to shout out, L'Hashem u'L'Gid'on, for the Lord and for Gid'on. And this completely destroys the Midianite camp. They are on the run, and that's the end of them. And it's a brilliant use of stealth intelligence, right? He knows exactly where the camp is and what their watches are. Guerrilla tactics. Somebody who saw Gid'on as his personal hero and who had his headquarters in Ein Harod was this gentleman here on the left. His name is Ord Wingate. He was known as Hayadid, the friend. He was by all accounts, a rather strange individual, eccentric, but he was also, by all accounts, a very staunch Zionist. And he comes to the land of Israel. He's a young man. He's in his 30s. He comes in 1936. He stays till 1939. He's a British officer. And he forms something called the Special Night Forces, and he trains the Jewish soldiers, right? Palmach, Haganah. He trains them to be better soldiers. What's his book of tactics? Tanakh, right? He likes the stories. He follows the stories of Gid'on, of Joshua, right? He uses intelligence, psychological warfare, guerrilla tactics. He's only here till 1939. The British don't like him. He's too Zionist. He gets kicked out, and he's actually killed in a plane crash in Burma in 1944. He's a very young guy, but he's a fascinating person. Today, we have a few places that are named after him, the Wingate Institute, Yamin Ord, a few other, those two are named for Ord Wingate. So fascinating guy. Okay, one last little piece about Gid'on's story. We're not going to go into all the details. He chases them across the Jordan. He has to capture the generals and the kings. But on his way chasing them, the men have been up since the middle of the night. They are battle weary. They're exhausted. They're thirsty. And Gid'on stops in two towns along the way, Sukkot and Penuel. And he says, give us some food and water. We're fighting for you. And they, as we've seen as the style in the book of Judges, they say, when you come back with the kings in prison, then we'll give you food and water. Meanwhile, who are you? And Gid'on vows that he's going to come back and he's going to punish all of these guys who have denied his soldiers what they need. And when he comes back, after he has indeed captured the kings, right, what does he do on his way back from the battle? Gid'on, son of Yoach, captured a boy from among the people of Sukkot and interrogated him. The latter, the boy, drew up for him a list of the officials and elders of Sukkot, 77 in number. And then he goes and he finds them and he punishes them. That's not what's important to me in the story. What's important to me in the story is he takes a kid off the street and the kid knows how to read and write. Right. That's fascinating, because if we talk about the early period of Israelite history, how literate were they? Right. And we have some early inscriptions. This is an inscription called the Gezer calendar. We have a few alphabets, but how literate were they? So this is a great proof that even a kid on the street knew how to read and write. And that's just a fascinating thing. Okay, two very short last things. The Jezreel Valley, like we said, super, super important throughout history. However, in the last few hundred years, even though it's an extremely fertile place, it was really neglected. The land was owned by Arab absentee landlords in Beirut and Damascus, and they kind of let it go to seed, swamps, malaria, mosquitoes. Things did not do well. We have a traveler's account of someone going through in the mid late 19th century, going through the valley and saying he sees one tree, right? And I'm going to show you a picture in a minute of what it looks like today. And yet, there was this guy, a little bit meshuggah, and that's how things get done. And his name was Yoshua Chanken. This is a young Yoshua with his quite older wife, who was really also an extraordinary person, Olga. And Yoshua Chanken was a serial land buyer. Okay, he's born in 1864. He lives till 1945. He is always buying land for the Zionist cause. And he comes to the Zionist authorities already in the early 20th century, and he says, we should buy the Jezreel Valley. The Jezreel Valley, he doesn't use this language, but I will use it for the benefit of all Americans who are here. The Jezreel Valley is going to be the Louisiana Purchase of the land of Israel. This is going to, we're going to get this land for relatively cheap, and it's going to become the breadbasket of the nation. And everybody thinks he's crazy, including the guys who want to sell him the land. There's no money. Nobody agrees. And it's only in 1920 that he manages to A, get the money, and B, convince the Zionist executive that this is a good idea. They buy this land. He is so pleased with this purchase that he builds a house above the valley, which today is in the national park of Mayan Charod. He doesn't ever get to live in it because his wife gets sick and they have to live in Tel Aviv, but they are both buried there, and today it's a beautiful museum to settlement in the valley and to Hankin. This is what the valley looks like today. It is definitely the heart of Israeli agriculture. It is a super important place. But even after it's bought by Hankin and there are new communities that move in, it is still a place of danger up until 1948. And we have a very beautiful, famous song called Shir HaEmek, the Song of the Valley, otherwise known as Ba Menucha LaYageya, and some people may be singing it to themselves, right? And it's all about the laboring in the valley, but, right, but my beloved valley, sleep my beloved valley, we will be your guardians, Anu Lecha Mishmeret, right? But look at the last paragraph. Mount Gilboa is darkened, a horse gallops from shadow to shadow, a voice is carried high over the fields of the valley. Who has shot? Who has fallen between Beit Alpha and Nahalal? And it's only after the War of Independence that the Jezreel Valley becomes not only a fertile place, but a secure place as well. And it's still very important, although not in the same sense as a battlefield, because today our weapons and our means of transportation are very different. Okay, lots of comments. Let's take a look. All right, let's see. Sorry. Okay. Some of the, right, we said mother's names, the map, the king should not have too many horses. Yes, too many horses is a problem because it leads to arrogance. But clearly having horses is very, very important. And we're going to come back to that when we talk about Achav. Oh, thank you, Irene. Viscounts are ennobled. Knights are lowered down. I'm not going to ask because it's too complicated for me. I am a democratic American. The derech l'tavor halachti levadi, right? Tavor is very evocative. The origin of the name Nablus, we said Neapolis. It's the Roman name, Neapolis, new city, and then the Arabs kind of contract that to Nablus. Other questions. Where did the iron come from? Okay, so we're going to talk about smelting and metal workshops when we get to the Philistines, and there are definitely metal workshops in this time period, although we could also say that maybe it comes from abroad. It doesn't have to necessarily come from here. Why are the names are modern names, Harish and Katsir, and they do refer to agriculture because here we are, right, in the breadbasket of the nation. They made the Syrians believe that there were many more IDF troops. Yes, we've used that over and over again. 1948, very, very much, right? The Davidka, if you know about the Davidka weapon, which was a gun that was invented for the War of Independence by the Jews. It made an awful lot of noise. It didn't cause any harm, right? A lot of ideas of psychological warfare. Someone who lives near me named Or, nice. What percent of Israel was liberated by Joshua? Again, we can see that from the map that I showed you, from the list in the first chapter of the book of Judges. It's hard to say. I would say a third to a half. I'm extrapolating to say how high was literacy. It's true. The biblical characters are often sui generis. It's possible, but I think it's interesting that this person is not mentioned. We don't know anything about him. He's a boy on the street. Embroidery from that time, right? Rikmato. Very hard to have something that would survive that long. We do have fabrics that have survived, but they are very rare. I do not know about any Canaanite or Sardona embroidery, although that would be super cool. Adam Zertal wrote a book about El Ahwat. If I could remember it, that would be good, the name of it. I don't know if it was translated into English. And there are, of course, a lot of different books, mostly in Hebrew, about these biblical sites. Another good source, again, if you read Hebrew, although that might be in English, is the Dat Mikra series on Tanakh, where they have maps and they identify things. Americans are great. My daughter is married to one. Okay. Any other comments? I would advise you all about Adam Zertal, the archaeologist. What do you mean, Irene? Do you want to speak and tell us? No? Okay. And I think we are done.
Point-wise about archaeology, and Adam Zertal discovered this settlement, this one in El Akhwat.
Correct. So he wrote a book. I don't know. I don't remember the name. I will try to find it and send it to Maxine and we can see it next time. But I don't think it's in English. That's the problem.
What did you want me to say? Shirley, what did you want me to talk
no,
about?
No, I was wondering what your question was.
No, about the Viscount, you mean? No, I was talking
about the Viscount.
You said you're a democratic American. I'm also democratic. I think we live, you know, that England ought to grow up a bit and go into the 21st century. Both.
But on the other hand, being the Viscount of Megiddo, you know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he did do a lot. He was a friend of Chaim Weizmann from Manchester, who, you know, from where I live. But yeah, I think Americans are fine. Don't worry.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you, everyone. Maxine, you have announcements?
Thank you. Yes, but first, I just wanted to address Charles' question about the subtitles. So if you look at the little menu bar kind of at the bottom of your Zoom screen, furthest to the right, there are three dots. They say more. Click on that, and then you can choose your subtitle settings from there. If those are distracting for you. Okay. For announcements, yes, tonight at 8:30 PM Eastern Time, there is a Parsha Shir. Rabbi Nathaniel Helfgott is teaching this week. What else? Then tomorrow at 9 o'clock. As usual, Rabbi Kelman is teaching his class on the Siddur. And on Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag's new class, looking at kind of different units, smaller pieces into like a larger context in Sefer Shemot, is continuing. So that'll be the second class in his new series. And then, yeah, that's for the second part of this week. And wishing everyone a Shabbat Shalom. And thank you for coming.
Thank you, everyone. Shabbat Shalom.